From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
El Cerrito,
Union Square,
San Francisco,
South of Market,
from Albany,
Hayes Valley,
Rock Ridge in Oakland.
I'm from the Civic Center. I live across the street.
Coming up, we'll find out what life is like for young people considering leaving the foster care system.
This is where AB12 gets tricky, because it means asking myself whether or not I can be as independent as I dream of being.
Then we'll explore the implications of new foster care laws.
It's clear at some point that if you don't invest in kids, it's going to cost you a lot later.
And we'll follow Youth Radio's intrepid reporters somewhere few men have gone before.
A lot of things happen here, like girls come in here and do their hair, don't go to class, they drink and smoke and stuff like that.
Taking you to new frontiers today on Cross Currents. About 4,000 foster youth emancipate each year in California. That means they turn 18 and are no longer eligible for state support, including housing. Many of them have no place to go. But a new law that went into effect this year aims to help them transition to adulthood. AB 12 allows foster youth to stay in state care until they're 20 years old. They get financial support and help finding housing and scholarships for college. They also have to check in with a social worker and have regular court dates. Advocates hope the law will reduce the chances that these young people will end up homeless. Kayla Say is in foster care and has been wrestling with the decision to take the extra support or to go out on her own as an independent adult. Youth Radio brings us her story.
I'm one of the first teens to choose whether to emancipate or stay in foster care under AB 12. I've been in the system for 2 years, and I feel iffy about whether I want to stay in. I want to be independent, and for the last 2 years, I've felt like the state has had control over my life. Every week, I go to a class called the Independent Living Skills Program, or ILSP. They teach me how to write checks, find an apartment, and budget money. Ken Shaw runs the Alameda County's ILSP. So I asked him, should I leave foster care or stay?
The con, if you will, is you have to put up with a social worker coming to see you once a month if you stay under AB 12. Also, the court continues to sort of be in your business. They want to make sure you're doing okay.
Lots of teens want to live independently. But for foster kids, there's a particular appeal. We'd get a shot at making our home stable. But on the other hand, sometimes I do need support, which is why I find this AB 12 decision really confusing. And apparently, I'm not the only one who's confused.
You know, there's some things about AB 12 that, because it's so new, nobody has really completely figured out yet.
That's my attorney, Peggy Stone, from the East Bay Children's Law Offices.
I think the most exciting thing is going to be the benefit that involves additional types of support housing to foster youth under AB 12.
Stone told me that the goal of the law isn't to keep youth like me under constant supervision. It's to make it easier for us to become independent. Every time I meet with advisors, they tell me to try out AB 12 so I can get the extra support. It makes me feel like they don't think that I'm ready to take care of myself. This is where AB 12 gets tricky, because it means asking myself whether or not I can be as independent as I dream of being. Ken Shaw made me question this point even more.
It's hard for an 18-year-old to be able to get a place to live independently, which means they probably have to hook up with a roommate of some kind. Perhaps some of them move back in with their parents, which may not be the best thing because their mom or dad maybe still be having problems. A lot of times we've had young people that have come to us at, you know, 18 and a half, 19, that are really on the street and are really desperate for a place to live, and we scurry around and try to find places for them.
The more I think about AB 12, the more I worry about whether I could live independently. I'm applying for full-time jobs, but I don't have one yet. I recently got my driver's license, but I don't have a car. I feel like I'm taking steps to reach my goals, but I haven't reached them yet. So for now, I want to stay in care under AB 12, at least until I feel like I'm financially stable. I don't like that the court will still have control over my decisions, but I'm willing to go along with it for now. And I'm looking forward to the day when I can get my very own apartment without asking anyone's approval. For Cross Currents, I'm Kayla Say.
That story was brought to us by Youth Radio. Thank you. And joining us to explain AB 12 is Daniel Heimpel of Fostering Media Connections. So, Daniel, in that piece, you know, young people and even lawyers were finding that AB 12 is confusing. Can you try and explain to us exactly how AB 12 works? What's in that bill?
Well, in 2010, the legislature passed AB 12 because we understand that foster youth, as they turn 18, have a very hard time transitioning to adulthood. Rates of incarceration, homelessness, and education are low. So you've got a situation where kids are not faring as well as their peers who are living with biological parents.
Because essentially, if you are in the foster care system and you age out, you get emancipated, you have no support network necessarily.
Yeah.
I mean, those of us who have parents oftentimes rely on our parents to help get us through, to pay rent that month if our jobs aren't... aren't paying enough or things like that.
Yeah, there's no support. There's no formalized support. So unless you were lucky enough through bouncing from placement to placement and school to school to first of all get a high school diploma, as 50% of foster youth in California do, if that, and you were lucky enough to find a permanent connection with an adult, maybe you have somebody who could help you navigate the very difficult world of applying for college, getting your first job, and all the rest. As a mentor, I saw two young men really struggling through that period. And as somebody really deeply invested in their lives, I saw how hard it was without any institutional support to make sure that they got a firm footing into their adulthood.
So AB 12 is supposed to provide support for this transition to adulthood.
Exactly.
But then it's phased in. So explain why it's phased in.
Well, it was phased in, the law to extend foster care to age 21, because California in 2010 was facing a budget deficit, kind of like it's facing right now, and phasing it in brought down the cost in the short term. So you could understand that there's 2,166 kids that will turn 19 in 2012, and so that creates a savings. The last fiscal analysis said that was about $1.6 million in a year. Not a huge amount, but at that time, people were looking for places to save.
So basically what that created was what you're calling this bubble.
Well, I mean, the advocates are calling it a funding bubble or a funding gap. And it created a situation where if you turn 19 in 2012, you could, by virtue of your birthday, be looking at your brothers and sisters in the foster care system who were born at a different date, who get to stay until age 21, and you don't. So
because the bill phases in, it allows you to stay in foster care, get support if you apply to this, if you're 19 this year and then 20 next year and then 21.
Right. So it was phased in from 18 to 19 in 2012, 19 to 20 in 2013, and 20 to 21 if the legislature approves it in 2014.
So that's creating this bubble. And maybe you wrote this good article called A Tale of Two Fridays, right? And you give us the example of this young man, David, in Contra Costa County. Maybe you could tell us his story to help us understand this.
So you had a young man, David, who had some learning disabilities, but was high functioning with Asperger's, who had got into UC Berkeley with good physics, but he was about to turn 19. So Contra Costa County said, well, at age 19, the funding dries up, so his monies will be terminated, the county monies will be terminated. So that's what they were doing, terminating his case, which meant that his foster care placement was ending. And before he graduated from high school, he was in the position where he didn't have a place to live. He would have to go live with a sister. Thank God he's got a sister. But for kids in even worse situations, that's facing them.
Okay. And so what's the legislature now trying to do to close this bubble?
Well, they've come through with a second wave of cleanup legislation. This is called AB 1712, designed to close the bubble. At the end of May, it made it through the Assembly. Now it's working its way through the Senate. And that would clean up that bubble, that funding gap for the 2,166 kids throughout the state who turned 19 in age 20 in 2012.
And you expect that this will be passed?
It made it through the state assembly unanimously, and it seems like there's a lot of momentum behind it. And when you look at the fiscal analysis, it may cost $1.6 million in this fiscal year, but the offset by 2016-17 is around $15 million in federal funds coming in for a different program. So there are federal funds coming in offsetting this anyway. So it's kind of a no-brainer.
So you say that everybody who was seeing this legislation, even supporters of the legislation, saw that there was going to be this problem. Why would you pass a bill with that kind of a huge built-in problem that's going to affect actual real people who are so vulnerable?
Well, I think that you've got to understand that California has 1/8 of the nation's foster care population. They were taking advantage of a federal law, and they were one of the first major state to take it up. So it was a historic moment. And I can empathize with being in this situation where people are going to say, we're going to kill this bill unless we get the numbers down. And you say, I got to get this through now to help out all those other kids who are turning 18 in 2012, who are not turning 19, but who are turning 18. And so that starts, if you didn't get it through, the sentiment was now or never. And so that's why that was created. That left counties in a very tough position.
And you mentioned the $1.6 million that this might cost in this fiscal year. But what we didn't talk about are the costs that don't get recorded that are intangible.
Right.
If kids are sort of just thrown out on their own at 18 and don't have housing or support or an education?
Well, there was a cost-benefit analysis done when AB 12 was working its way through. And it said for every dollar you spent past the age of 18 on these youth, you'd get a 2.4 return, $2.40 return on every dollar invested. And that was just an increased earning capacity because of higher college attendance rates, not even graduation rates. That didn't count incarceration and all the rest. So despite, I mean, it's child advocates can make the mantra forever, and they've got cost-benefit analysis through the wazoo, and that doesn't seem to penetrate. But it's clear at some point that if you don't invest in kids, it's going to cost you a lot later. And it's interesting to see how the legislature has responded to this bubble issue in the light of a lot of media coverage and the rest, kind of making that case. So I think if that case were made more broadly, I think it would penetrate a little bit more. But I mean, it's just obvious. It's obvious that these kids need support, and that's going to help us.
Daniel Heimpel is the executive director of Fostering Media Connections. You can see more of our foster care coverage and find links to youth radio work at our website. It's klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. One of the biggest challenges for young people leaving foster care is finding a job. Youth employment in the United States is the lowest it's been in 60 years. Young people graduating from high school struggle to find jobs and also face drastic college tuition increases. The question for many educators is how to really prepare students in high school for a career. And according to Forbes magazine, careers in the healthcare sector are among the top recommended jobs for young people. That's because these jobs include entry-level opportunities, don't always require a college degree, and demand hands-on interaction. To help students learn about these careers, Oakland High School is experimenting with a public health academy. It's a small learning community that focuses on preparing students for jobs in healthcare. And these students are not afraid to get their hands dirty. Youth Radio's Linnea Lewis reports.
If you are a girl at Oakland High School, the last thing you will want to do is use the girls' bathroom. You're better off holding it. Vicky Hong, a 10th grader there, tries to avoid it at all costs.
Personally, the last time I used this bathroom was freshman year, and I'm already a sophomore, so it's... Why? Because look at it. It's like, it smells different. A lot of things happen here, like girls come in here and do their hair, don't go to class, they drink and smoke and stuff like that.
She willingly took on the responsibility of creating awareness around the bathroom situation, along with two of her classmates, Monisha Stroman and Monica Collins. They wanted to see what types of bacteria were living in the bathrooms they used, so they went around with swabs and petri dishes. Their findings surprised them.
We discovered mold, black fungi.
We did things like the toilet seat. We did things like the door handle, the toilet paper handle, the soap handle, the floor around the toilet.
After swabbing the girls' bathroom, they prepared a presentation for the ninth grade girls to encourage them to take care of their bathrooms, exceeding their teacher, Karen Sills, expectations.
They actually talked to the principal of our school and got electric hand dryers put in the girls' bathroom. They talked to the custodians and made sure that the bathrooms could be clean every morning, got the custodians to actually wash the mirrors.
Swabbing high school bathrooms might seem far away from landing a job in health, but according to Seals, co-director and teacher in the Public Health Academy, this field is all about getting familiar with your environment and sharing those findings with your community. For these students, it starts with their school.
And they actually had to spend some time evaluating what was going on and come up with solutions that could make all those places better. So the students can be more culturally appropriate in bringing those health messages back to their peers.
One of the ways students are getting familiar with the larger community outside of school walls is by working in public health internships for school credit.
We're trying to get them ready to actually go out in the field and be active in the public health careers, which we know that there's a growing need for in our community.
Seals has already started to see some interest from students, like 15-year-old Monisha Stroman.
Yeah, I want to be either a nurse, maybe a doctor, maybe even a paramedic. I don't know all the careers exactly yet, but I've been learning pretty much a little bit, parts by part. But I know I'm going to be in the medical area. I plan on going to UCLA and go to medical school there.
Through the academy, students have already gotten internships at local hospitals. But Seals' ultimate goal is to prepare students for life after high school.
There are a lot of medical fields to be involved in, such as x-ray technician, phlebotomist, respiratory therapist, nurse's assistants, that there's a huge need for. And those are just a two-year certification program. So we want to get them prepared for that also, so they can actually graduate high school employable.
While the bathroom crew is still only in 10th grade, they are coming up against a common challenge in the public health field, how to get your message to stick. 1 week after their presentation to the ninth grade girls, one bathroom at Oakland High looks pretty much the same. Nail polish on the walls and mirrors, and paper towels on the floor and ceiling. But even though their message didn't last very long, the girls walked away with real skills. Data collection, chemical analysis, all things essential for medical careers. The first Public Health Academy graduates will get their diplomas in 2014. For Cross Currents, I'm Linnea Lewis.
That story comes to us from Youth Radio's New Options Desk. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. For the teenagers at Oakland High School, public health isn't an abstract idea. It's part of their day-to-day lives. The same is true for the 32 million Americans who would receive access to health care under President Obama's health care reform bill, the Affordable Care Act. But just because you can pay a doctor doesn't mean you have one to visit. There's currently a shortage of primary care physicians in some areas of the nation, and it's about to get worse.
The shortage is becoming nationwide.
That's Thomas Bodenheimer, adjunct professor at UCSF's Department of Family and Community Medicine. He's one of the nation's leading scholars in the primary care workforce.
There are areas that are what we call primary care shortage areas, and those areas are now expanding. By 2020, there will be about 40,000 adult primary care physicians too few in this country.
That's pretty dire. But listen to this. The Association of American Medical Colleges recently revised its shortage forecast from 40,000 to 60,000 physicians that will be needed by 2015. In case you weren't paying attention, that's a lot worse. So you might be wondering, who's going to take care of us? Well, the National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine has a solution: nurse practitioners. A 2010 report by the Institute said that giving nurse practitioners a greater and more independent role could help the nation adapt to the changing healthcare system. In this piece from 2010, KALW's Erica Mu reports on that controversial conclusion.
Ah, the impending doctor shortage, or rather the shortage of adult primary care physicians. You might not feel it now, but with an aging population and 32 million newly insured Americans entering the system, you'll probably feel it soon. Only 7% of fourth-year med school students are planning careers in adult primary care, a supply problem that's been described by none other than NPR's All Things Considered as a potential crisis.
The U.S. is facing a potentially catastrophic shortage of primary care doctors and other health professionals.
Well, doctors who are in training are going into every field except primary care, according to a report earlier this month in the New England Journal of Medicine.
In contrast, over 85% of nurse practitioner graduates enter into primary care, and they usually stay there. Two-thirds of the 135,000-plus nurse practitioners across the nation are currently in primary care. Most importantly, a fifth of these nurse practitioners work in rural areas, places that are already hurting from a physician shortage. Places like Modesto.
Vasco Road. Currently 64 degrees in Modesto and 58 in Stockton. Congratulations to Susan Mackey of Riverbank.
We're in Modesto, California. The practice is Aspen Family Medical Group of Modesto. My name is Matt Freitas, and I'm a nurse practitioner and physician assistant.
It's 8 a.m. at the clinic in Modesto, but the waiting room is already full. Freitas says that Aspen Family Medical Group takes everyone, whether or not they have insurance.
20% of the patients we see for free every day.
And it's believable. The clinic is housed in a large strip mall where the 99-cent store is only two doors down from the Dollar Tree. And by the looks of the waiting room this morning, the clinic's services are appreciated by members of the local community. Members of the medical community, however, aren't Freitas' biggest fans.
They've made complaints to hospitals about me. I have staff privileges at one of the hospitals here, and there were complaints made against me.
Physician complaints against Freitas reflect a larger turf war in primary care, and clinics like his are the battleground. Aspen is the largest nurse practitioner-owned clinic in the state. Sort of. Freitas owns 49% and not a bit more because in California, practices must be led by a physician. It's different in different states. If we were in Washington, Freitas wouldn't have to collaborate with a physician to run a clinic. He could diagnose, treat, and prescribe on his own.
The politics get pretty thick.
Dr. Kevin Grumbach is a practicing physician and professor in family and community medicine at UCSF.
So I think from the physician community, there's some that just, you know, don't let a nurse practitioner at all encroach on our turf.
That sensibility goes right to the top. Joseph Heyman, former chairman of the board of the American Medical Association, was quoted as saying, "Non-physician healthcare providers serve a vital role on a physician-led healthcare team. However, the health and safety of patients is threatened when healthcare providers are permitted to perform patient care services that are beyond their level of education and training." End quote. A staff editorial from the American Academy of Family Physicians said,
"These personnel are an essential component in ensuring patients receive timely and quality health care, but they're not qualified to lead the medical home as independent practitioners."
But for policymakers, what might be most convincing is the savings. According to a Rand Corporation study, expanding mid-level responsibilities could mean healthcare savings of $8.4 billion by 2020. That's based on the assumption that nurse practitioners provide comparable care, something some physicians will readily admit.
They probably could take care of 85% of what the doctors could take care of, frankly, and often better.
Michael Zimmerman owns his own small private practice in Oakland. He's not really advocating for independent nurse clinics, but he does think that nurse practitioners would work well as the front line of preventative care.
By using care team members, physician extenders, to take care of work that can be done outside of the visit, that actually frees the visit up for a much more meaningful encounter. We are all for the use of anyone and everyone to deliver care, including patients themselves. I think it's how they all work together that's essential.
Working together may not be the revolutionary answer some nurse practitioners are looking for, But UCSF professor Kevin Grumbach sees it as a fair compromise that shifts the role of both nurse practitioners and doctors.
Who we are in primary care and what we're trying to accomplish. It's no longer this sort of iconic one family doctor who can do everything and is going to give the shots and do a little minor surgery and deliver the baby and then run off to the hospital for the person who's just had the heart attack and then hold your hand in the office. It's actually going to be a team that has to do that.
The limitations on nurse practitioners are still up to state policymakers, but the Federal Department of Health and Human Services awarded $15 million for nurse-managed health clinics and $31 million in grant money to nursing schools. And if you're one of the 94,000 patients who will receive access to health care because of the grant money, you very well may find that your primary caregiver is not a doctor, but a nurse practitioner. For Cross Currents, I'm Erica Mu.
If you have an experience with nurse practitioners that you'd like to share, you can visit our Facebook page. We're KALW News. You can also find us online at kalw.org. That's where you can subscribe to our podcast. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Buffy Almendares, Hanna Baba, Julie Kane, Artem Skunachovs, Audrey Dilling, Lupe Hernandez, Lisa Ratner, Erica Mu, Seth Samuel, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And a big thanks to you. We are listener-supported radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.